a very great friend of the Jewish community and of Israel. And you will be coming to a case where at times people will believe not just in a traditional morality, but in a biblical morality. All the while believing not just in some complicated Trinitarian theology about which much has been written in halacha, how you relate to that, but literally that human beings, through practicing religion, can become God, and so on and so forth. So would we need a different set of guidelines than the Christian community as a whole? I think it's very possible. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't work with them, but it does mean that that not much has been written on it, and I don't know yet how to fully answer your question. What I would suggest is that it will come up very soon as the Mormon community grows tremendously in terms of and will establish its own religious identity as a powerful religious institution in America. To add on to that point, another interesting dimension that complicates things is that the reverse proposition. You'll have somebody who is very purely monotheistic, like the Jews, but there are other issues which complicate matters. For instance, there was a coalition for marriage set up in the United States between representatives of various organizations, including the OU, the Orthodox Union, to get together to work to stop gay marriage, which I understand is an issue in Ontario as well. And one of the members of this coalition, and now in Massachusetts, today actually, but what I understand caused the controversy is that one of the members of this was a Muslim group which has spoken very positively, I think, about terrorism. So you have both issues. You have somebody who can quite literally be an Oved Avodah Zara in terms of the halakhic sense of the term, but is quite powerfully attached to this interest of the Jews and the Jewish state. And you have certain people who will share our moral values because they share a strictly monotheistic perspective, but hate the Jewish people. And how that will influence future things remains to be seen as well. So it's a great question. Thank you for it. Yeah.
Your statement that liberal democracy is the most fertile ground for truth to proliferate, I'm having trouble understanding.
Right.
In the davening at Mincha, we pray for the reinstitution of many things, the Sanhedrin, the Kohanim, the Kohen Gadol bringing offerings, the same environment that would allow all the Jewish institutions functioning at their optimum would allow for a Jew who publicly violates Shabbos to be put to death.
Okay.
Doesn't the Torah say that Jewish theocracy is the most fertile ground for truth?
Well, no. What it does say, great question, is that in the end times, and the ultimate culmination of our hopes and dreams, is a Jewish monarchy / theocracy. Absolutely. Absolutely. I did not say that liberal democracy is, by definition, the most fertile ground. What I do believe is that in an age in which, as certain people such as the Chazon Ish or Karelis and others have stressed, in an age where no religion can prove itself, in which the truth of one religion is not made manifestly clear, then I think liberal democracy does follow halakhically. Absolutely, as my grandfather, Aaron Soloveitchik, has argued, and others. Ultimately, of course, both Christians and Jews, who both endorse liberal democracy, believe the culmination of the world will be a theocracy. Who will be ruling that theocracy is an issue of debate between Jews and Christians. But both believe that ultimately the truth of a certain religion will be made manifestly, obviously clear. And at that point, everyone will come to accept the truth of that religion because that the religion will be made so manifestly clear. So in that case, the search for truth takes on a totally different aspect. That said, do I believe the Torah would endorse a system of punishing people for Shabbos violations now? I don't believe that, and I don't think halachas believe that.
No.
Yeah. So you're asking, right, I understand. So what I'm telling you is that I think that, and I believe, and I think halacha believes, that until the coming of the Messiah, until the truth of, we believe the Jewish faith, Christians believe the Christian faith, ultimately I think will be proven right, Otherwise, I wouldn't be a rabbi, and I could trade in my black skull cap for a red one. But ultimately, both faiths believe in a theocracy. Ultimately, there's no question about it. That said, I do believe that until the end times, Christians have come to believe, and I think Jews have come to believe, and I think we should believe, and I think Halacha does believe, that a government of civil liberties is the right and most moral one. I think if you believe that the Halacha believes that nowadays, do you believe that the Halacha believes that nowadays we should have a theocracy? So we're in agreement. No, liberal theocracy doesn't put truth on hold. It doesn't have the full revelation of the truth. But liberal democracy with a religious foundation says, okay, let's search for the truth. And different people can be free to freely assert what they believe is the truth and not be punished for it. And that, I think, is a good thing. Ultimately, theocracy will be established. Let's all look forward to it, people. But seriously, that both Jews and Christians are in agreement that ultimately, the truth of a particular faith will be manifestly clear. And both faiths agree on that. It's a good question. Thank you.
Okay, I have two short observations, okay, and then maybe you can react to these. I think, for my part, I think that you have granted some religious truth, at least with a small t,
right,
to Christianity.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, well, that's important for me to hear. Right. And perhaps even participating in that larger truth, which we believe is the belief in God, okay, something granted by the Neri, and incidentally written on so very well by Rabbi Turin, one of the former Rosh Yeshivas at Neri Yisrael, who is here with us today. Is that true, then, that you believe in such, that there is that?
There are certain truths which we share, and part there are a great deal of religious propositions which are true,
okay,
which Christianity and Judaism have in common. That said, you have to say, when you say they partake in that truth, it depends what you mean by partake.
Well, they partake in...
They believe
in it. That there is a God, that there is a creator.
The
position of the Meiri.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I believe that. That, I think, I've made clear. What it doesn't mean, therefore, is that Christianity, as Christians believe, that by acknowledging the God of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, that they've become part of the Jewish covenant in any way. That we do reject.
Okay.
So we have to be careful when we say we partake in a particular thing.
Okay.
Good.
The second matter, I just want to offer you my view about religious dialogue with Christianity.
Okay.
And to me, it's very striking that the Rav was talking about this issue 40 years ago,
right
after the Holocaust. Now, some of us would only learn decades later, and this has been written so brilliantly, self-standing by Christian religious writers, about the role of Christianity in the Holocaust itself. And I myself, if talking to a Christian, would say, I feel no need, no compulsion, no necessity to dialogue with you at this existential and historic moment, okay, when we have emerged, when we are only emerging now from this Holocaust. In other words, there seems to be some ethical position that we must talk with them while we are confronted by the reality, again, so eloquently said by Christians, that they and their faith gave birth to...
Good. That's an important point, so let me respond to that. Okay, the Rav was very well aware of the role that Christian anti-Semitism played in encouraging those who acted in the Holocaust and so forth, in the Holocaust. That said, it's important to note that in the Rav's essay on confrontation, he makes no mention of that. I'm sure he emotionally felt it, but when you look at, if you want to borrow a treasury of tradition, and look at the guidelines, the Rav did believe there was an ethical obligation to engage other faiths on these moral issues and distinctly religious morals. He did believe there was that obligation. He said you should avoid strictly theological issues, but he did believe there's an ethical obligation. What made confrontation, this essay, such a revolutionary essay, is not just, people always say, oh, well, the important part of the essay is that the Rabbi Soloveitchik banned dialogue on theological issues. But the other part, equally important, is that he urged dialogue on ethical issues. And he felt that was part and parcel of our obligation. Do we have certain grievances? Sure we have grievances. But is that an excuse? If Jews have an obligation to enhance the moral welfare of humanity, and part of the way that can be enhanced is by dialoguing with those who agree with us on particular moral issues. So we can't say as an excuse, well, we don't have that chiyuv at the moment, we don't have that obligation, because we have these grievances. We can talk about our grievances and we can write history. That said, and we can rejoice, as the Rav said, that at a time when the Christian, after 2,000 years of the Christian faith pointing to the statelessness of the Jews as the ultimate proof that of God's rejection of them, we can rejoice that this has been disproven, as the Rav himself has said in other lectures. That said, that's not an excuse for engaging. And the Rav did believe there was that obligation. People always quote the first part of Confrontation, well, the Rav banned theological issues, but he urged dialogue on other issues. That's very important. In contrast to other Gedolim, who did feel that, no, we can't touch this, which was Ramosha Feinstein's position, but not Rabbi Soloveitchik's. Yes?
Sure. So, a prerogative. It is getting a little late-ish. Those who want to stay here late are welcome. We'll talk all night.
I could be here all night. Yeah.
Right, and tomorrow morning. And so what I'm going to do is the people standing in line, if they can all ask maybe their questions one after another,
okay.
If that's okay.
Can you give me a
and
pen?
Then maybe give a wrap-up answer.
Okay.
And then we're our refreshments. And
thank
Rav
you.
Meir was willing to talk, you know,
absolutely.
A little longer. But that way, it's fair to everyone.
Sorry, my point is this term dialogue.
Yes.
It's one thing to participate together, and the other is this term dialogue, because as you say, it often can lead to let's find common ground.
That's right.
And the groups that we, the Jewish various institutions, have been in dialogue with, the Catholic Church, the mainline Protestant Church, we haven't been in much dialogue with the evangelicals.
Right.
Now, surprisingly, or not surprisingly perhaps, it's those very ones that we've been in dialogue with who don't seem to get it.
Right.
We've become very much allied with those who don't see eye to eye, especially on the most important issue, Israel, right now.
Right.
And yet the evangelicals, with whom we've never engaged in, and nobody particularly wants to engage in New York, those are the ones who seem to, we have common interests on what's most important to us. So what too often happens in dialogue is just the total lack of self-respect we have.
Absolutely.
And you read Dabru Emet, and clearly this is an obsequious piece.
It's a great question, and I'm going to comment on it as soon as I get all the other questions. Fabulous question. Yeah.
Hopefully I've understood you correctly that your grandfather, the Rav,
the Rav was my great-uncle.
Your great-uncle, excuse me, would have allowed, for instance, a 9/11 community event in which community leaders were invited, religious leaders to consult the community, or if there was a discussion on humanitarian issues such as, let's say, the homelessness, that a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, would not only be allowed to participate in the event, but actually be encouraged on behalf of the community. If that is true, if I've understood it correctly, there seems to be, in our time, I'm not sure if it's a phenomenon, where Orthodox rabbis, both in your city, sometimes in our city, will not appear with conservative or reform rabbis on the same stage, or even have discussion of an educational nature. And I was just wondering what you think your great uncle would have said on that issue.
You have a mitzvah, B'nai Noach, or the Noachite laws. Now, according to the Rambam in Hilchot Melachim, when a goy violates any of the seven mitzvot, there's harsh penalties as opposed to a Jew. If a non-Jew violates any of the mitzvot, even theft, he's guilty of a capital crime. And not only that, he doesn't have to be warned. He could steal less than a pruta. So how could we teach these ethics when it's so discriminatory, the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, towards going?
Okay, good question. Let me answer all good questions. Let me answer all of them. First question was about dialogue with evangelicals, and that also, at the moment, much of the dialogue has been with people who sometimes, quite frankly, don't like us a lot. Absolutely true. The Dabru Emet statement, which was basically a summation of things which, according to the statement we have in common, basically breezily ran through many, many different things. Jews and Christians worship the same God, it said. We both get authority from the same book. We work together for justice and peace, and so on and so on and so forth. Now, your point is that why is it important to dialogue with Christians in the first place? What is it important for? So, you can give two answers. One approach is for moral issues, meaning to traditional Judaism has a distinctively moral worldview, which is different often than the secularist world. Well, in much of the mainline Protestant communities, that's not a factor. It's certainly not a factor. On the contrary, we have more in common with evangelicals on that. Israel, the fact is, it's precisely the ones who are so firmly believed in the exclusive truth of their own dogma that are so pro-Israel. So I agree. What I think the traditional Jewish community should do is to put out a statement of their own, not a Dabru Emet on focusing specifically on theological commonalities, but to say, evangelicals, and I would say Catholics, although the Catholic Church itself has not been as pro-Israel as it should, it certainly has not been, on family issues, they're a critical ally, critical, and the most powerful one, absolutely. So what the Orthodox Jewish community should do, I think, is put out a statement on what basic moral beliefs that we share and focus the statement on moral issues and print that ad in the New York Times or somewhere else and print it in evangelical magazines and in Catholic magazines and so forth. And then let the dialogue begin. A fascinating element of the religious world in America has been the fact that traditional Catholics and traditional evangelicals have formed real bonds. Now, this is striking theologically because if you went 40 years ago, evangelicals believed that the Pope was the Antichrist. That they were supposed to believe that, some of them. So what's happened? The answer is that in an age of secularism, they begin to see each other more as allies. That should be encouraged, I think, with Jews as well. So I think that's true. In terms of the Rav on different denominations, first of all, you mentioned in terms of different religions, you mentioned two different things, a discussion on homelessness. Absolutely. Then you mentioned one of consoling. Now, you're raising the interesting question of a prayer service, an interreligious prayer service. I don't know what the Rav would say about that. I don't know. Interdenominational, how that relates to interdenominational issues, it's really a very, very different question. And the Rav did allow, I think, at times, membership in the Synagogue Council of America for the Orthodox community. But how he would respond on the specifics of interdenominational dialogue, I was not a student of my great uncle. He got sick when I was very young. I don't know, and it's not for me to say. But it is different. That's all I'm saying. The difference could mean that there'll be more dialogue on religious issues at times. It could mean not that. But it is a very, very different. Very, very different question. Last question, which is a good question about the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. Doesn't the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach seem morally problematic? Why? Let me just explain the question. The Gemara says that the punishment for a violation of one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach is death. And you don't need a warning because in the phrase of the Gemara, az harasan zuhi misasan. The warning, the prohibition, is itself a warning. Now, my grandfather has argued, and this is absolutely true, I believe this with absolute certainty, that what the Gemara means is not that any non-Jew who steals a penny, the Gemara would advocate cutting off his head. What it means is that death, the capital punishment, is a option, not only for, let's say, murder, but also for theft and so forth. For instance, what does theft mean? Let's say we say that one of the Noahide laws is a prohibition of theft. What does theft mean? Theft can mean stealing a penny, but theft can also mean kidnap and rape. The reason, according to the Rambam, the violation that was the rape of Dina was kidnapping and rape. Is capital punishment always uncalled for in a case of kidnapping and rape? I'm not so convinced that's true. What the Gemara is not saying is that you're obligated to execute anyone who violates any one of the basic moral laws. What it means is that the death penalty, in contrast for the Sanhedrin, the death penalty for a civil Noahide government, the death penalty is an option, even for non-murder crimes. Now you'll say, well, still there's a difference between Judaism, between the halacha and the Noahide laws. The truth is there isn't, because there is a notion of Mishpat HaMelech, the civil authority within Judaism as well, not the Sanhedrin, but the king in halacha, who's also able if appropriate, to punish with capital punishment for other crimes, not just for murder. There's a whole wide modern halachic literature showing the link between the Noahide laws and the and the laws of the king, as set out by the Rambam and others for the laws of the Israelite monarchy. In other words, the halacha recognizes within the Jewish political system two different authorities: a religious authority, which is the Sanhedrin, who have certain very strict guidelines and who can only punish so rarely that, in the words of the Sanhedrin, they only punish with capital punishment once every 70 years, if that. But a government can't function that way. Sometimes you have to kill people. That's just the way things are. So you have a, that's going to be the quote of the night. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, sometimes you have to kill people. But the Jewish newspapers, all over the internet, send. But the fact is, sometimes you have to kill people if they're a danger to society. So that option has to be left open, both, and that's left open both within the Noahide law and within the Mishpat HaMelech, the area of Jewish monarchy, of Jewish law. We have options for civil punishment with death, and we have options of civil punishment with corporal punishment. We don't do that here. But people ask, let's talk about the Aguna problem for a moment. Okay? The Aguna problem is a serious problem. Okay? Now, in a fully functioning Jewish government society, this was never a problem. Why? Because a husband who refused to give a get would be beaten. And beaten until either she would be divorced or she would be a widow. But the problem would be resolved. That does not mean, and I am not endorsing, corporal punishment in a modern-day democracy. What it does show is that you have certain halachos which allow for punishment, not just when called for misas beisdin, for punishment, but it may be inaccurate. I don't know if they punished him, if they would beat a recalcitrant husband until he died or until 1 inch of his life. That's a whole discussion. That's a separate point. But the point is, we have extra halachic punishments, both corporal punishments and death, in times not called for by the halacha. That's civil punishment for the Mishpat HaMelech, and that's also punishment for the Noahide laws. I'm working on an essay on this, but I do believe, based on my grandfather, the Gemara never meant that you are obligated to punish a Noahide for, let's say, stealing a penny with capital punishment. I do not believe that, and it would be very morally problematic if that's what the Gemara was saying. So I'll end on that note. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Torah in Motion, first of all, it's our pleasure once again to thank the Shire family for sponsoring this lecture. And in the schus of the ideas that have been discussed here and wrestled with, it should be an aliyah from the neshama of Shoshana Shire. We also want to greatly extend our thanks to Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik for a very provocative and thought-provoking evening. And the ideas that were discussed here are available on CD, and they'll be available in a few days, and we encourage everybody to purchase a copy to go back over the kinds of things that were discussed tonight as well. We want to remind everyone that the third in our series of Seeking God is this coming Sunday night with Erica Brown, in which she's going to discuss seeking God in a communal context organized around her reading of the Book of Ruth. So we encourage everybody to be here on Sunday night, Victoria Day weekend, the 23rd, at 8 o'clock. In addition, if people have an extra moment of patience and haven't signed in or are not on our email list, there's paper on each table that you can sign in. And in a general way, we want to encourage you to get as involved as you'd like with Torah in Motion. We have a big year planned for next year with a number of major events. And just to forecast now, our third annual Renewing Our Spirit Conference, our major conference of the year, is going to be on Sunday, November 7th, and we'd like everyone to mark that date away. And we're going to be bringing in a number of major people in the coming year, and we have a number of conferences planned. So I would make two suggestions. Number one, if there are issues and people that you would like to see, please let Rabbi Kalman and myself know, because it's that kind of thing that we get to work on. And as well, if you want to be involved in Torah Motion anyway, you can check out our website or send us an email at info@torahinmotion.com. Thank you, .org, and we thank everybody for coming. Good night.